Al and Ann will have about a 10-minute conversation amongst ourselves, and we'll take questions from you all. But thank you very much for your patience. Starting the back row, Tim Roth. Brendan Nasira. Cameron Taylor. Bruce Curry. Front row, Kurt Russell. Jennifer Baker Lee. Brian Tarantino. Samuel L. Jackson. And Walter Goddard.
Ooh, it's levels.
Yeah.
This is first.
I invited you guys to this telethon for a reason.
Levels.
Thank you. You and Jennifer sit next to each other and everything. Is that right?
It's rough for us because we usually you're over the other way around.
Quentin, I'm going to start with Quentin, thank you guys for coming. Thank you for your patience. I'm going to ask a question about ultra-panavision. Obviously, it's epic in scale in terms of what it gives you in the frame, but I want to talk about what it gives your actors in terms of intimacy, in terms of the close-ups, no. In terms of the relationship of one actor to the other, and what that means to you as a filmmaker to be able to shoot actors in 70mm.
Well, you've actually kind of answered kind of your own question a little bit. No, because literally that is the one of the tricks that I thought about was the intimacy that it... provides you in particularly in close-ups. I mean, I've shot a lot of close-ups of this man right here, but I've never shot them as beautiful as I did in this movie. I mean, there is a. I mean, I think you find yourself taking backstrokes in his eyes.
Oh,
all
so
right,
beautiful.
I mean, it's just
so awesome.
Yeah, it's just the way it is, you know. But one of the things that I remember when I did the film. When it was reported that I was going to do it in this format, people were actually speculating, and I guess I understand it. They were like, well, yeah, okay, that sounds all really great, but why would he do it for a thing that's just so set-bound? And, you know, I think that's actually just kind of not a very profound thinking when it comes to 65mm, that it's basically just for shooting travelogues or shooting mountain sceneries nature and stuff. I actually felt that, especially in bringing it into Minnie's haberdashery, if the film isn't suspenseful, i.e. the pressure cooker situation of what's going on in the movie, if that's not part of it, if the threat of violence and the pressure cooker situation if the temperature isn't always getting upped a notch every scene or so, then the movie's going to be boring. It's not going to work. And I actually felt that the big format would, one, it would put you in Minnie's haberdashery. You are in that place. You are amongst those characters. And I thought it would make it more intimate when I got in close with them. But the other thing that I thought would be very, very important is there's always two plays going on in this movie. Once you're in Minnie's in particular, there's two plays going on at all times. There's the characters that are in the foreground of any given scene, and then there's the characters in the background. And you always have to be keeping track, especially in this scenario, of where everybody is. It's like they're pieces on a chessboard, and you always have to see it. And so maybe it might be Chris Mannix and General Smithers who are dealing, but you're also clocking Joe Gage at his table, and you're clocking John Ruth and Daisy at the bar, and that becomes important. Unless I don't want it to be, unless I want to cut them out and not show it to you. But I think that helped ration up the tension as things went on.
And for the actors themselves, I mean, one of the limitations about 70 typically is that the magazines are very short, a little wonky, but it means you have very short takes. But you were able to equip your cameras with a lot more film, so you could shoot your actors for 6 and 7 minutes at a time.
Yeah, even longer than that. I mean, the Panavision came up with a 2,000-foot mags, all right, where we were able to like shoot it for 11 minutes at a time. which, I mean, I can't even imagine doing this material if we had to break it up in 4-minute goes. We had to do it like that. I mean, the only real big limitation that I had as far as my shooting was, the Weinsteins were very generous with me, so I didn't have to dole out the footage in a certain way. I mean, I wasn't completely cavalier about it, but I didn't really change my shooting style for it, and that wouldn't have been the idea, is to completely change my shooting style. So I shot the way I wanted to shoot. However, the only real disadvantage I felt at the time, but then I don't feel now, was we weren't able to get a zoom lens. And I had really gotten used to using a zoom lens and the little zoom creep. I've really gotten used to that. But actually, that was also kind of a nice thing to not actually to be forced to not use all the tools that you've gotten used to from time to time and be able to work in a different way.
I'm going to ask this question to Demian Channing and Jennifer, whoever wants to answer. You guys are all virgins to a Quentin Seth, rookies, whatever you want to call it, neophytes. When you're asking the other
actor, rookies, neophytes, amateurs, bottom of the list, bottom of the totem pole,
bitch.
Practically interns. They paid me.
Expect, and what is surprising about being on a Quentin set that's different from other movie sets?
Well, first off, it is an actual alumni to, I think, be in a Quentin film, and you really feel that. All these guys have worked together a lot, and it is a unique experience to be in a Quentin movie, I can promise you. And you're really intimidated, but every single person was so, I mean, Sam, I did my first movie ever with Sam. And to come full circle like this is pretty extraordinary. I think on the first day, I must have looked so geeked out because the very first shot was this crazy, like,
oh, the 360 one, yeah.
Like, and I'm just like wide eyed and trying to figure out what not to screw up. And Tim goes, "Yep, you're about to be in the Quentin too." Like, pull it together, Chan. Like, I'm scared. But it was amazing. I mean, every single person here is people I admire greatly, and was learning lessons every single moment.
Can I just add one thing to that was funny? I told him on when we were in rehearsal, I go, "You do realize you get to shoot Coach Carter, don't you?" I hadn't thought about that. Holy shit, I get to shoot Coach Carter.
All those suicide. All those suicides. All those push-ups.
Channing hasn't seen the film yet, so you're kind of spoiling it there.
Yeah.
Get back.
I was there for some of it.
Okay. I want to ask Jennifer and Kurt about, are you guys, and I said this when we came in, maybe your mics weren't on, you guys always still sit side by side, and were you side by side throughout the show? Meaning, when the cameras weren't on, did you try to actually chain yourselves to one another?
This is probably the first time we've ever sat like this. This is very
uncomfortable. I was thinking that, yeah, you're in the wrong spot.
They were literally
side.
Complaining about it just before the thing started.
We're starting to go with it, and I say, bullshit, let's change it.
Dude, we'll give you 2 seconds. We're going to just a minute. There you go.
Now it's okay.
Now all is right with
all
the world.
Right with the world.
The balance of axis have.
I almost felt like I was on a date or something. This is much more right.
But Kurt, after your character is no longer among the living, is that still you lying on the floor there?
Yeah, you know, I spent 4.5 months chained to Jennifer, and I. It felt very strange, the concept of people starting to drop like flies, and the actors that had been there for us were not going to be there for them. It just felt really weird. Aside from the fact that I had a really good ticket, a front row seat to watch all these guys and not have to worry about lines, and I just listen to it and watch it be played out. But I wanted to be there for her to do whatever she needed to do. Look, in the movie, I'm dead for whatever period of time it is. It's not 3 weeks or however long it took us to do it. So for her, you know, if she felt like she needed to paw John Ruth, that's going to be different than a dummy. And I knew that by being there and by continuing the day-to-day that we all had, talking to each other, and it just was something that had to happen.
until that time you fell asleep.
Yeah, that's true. that was like, Jennifer, why did you stop? Because John Ruth is snoring.
Dear guy snoring.
Dear guy snoring.
They had a dummy for him. It was 30 degrees in that room, you know? So they had a full dummy with a full face cast, beautiful, like you couldn't tell from far away. Walton has a lot of videos.
Walton has. This video sat in a chair in the makeup room, and different people would go up and just slap John Ruth. Okay, here.
Bam!
Or just like play with his mustache.
Well, like suck his dick in his mouth.
I don't want to say that. But now that you mention it.
Private film.
Sorry, go ahead, Alex. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Footage can be found on the Black Web.
I've got a question for Sam. Other actors can jump in.
She wasn't finished.
She wasn't doing her job.
I do want to say one thing, which is I couldn't have done that scene without him there. And that's really was 3 weeks of like 16-hour days lying on a cold floor. But I needed him, and he was so there for me, and it was just like it really, really touched me because as much as Daisy wanted to kill him, you know, be careful what you wish for. And I would never have really, truly experienced that had he not been there for me to paw and miss and feel the heat leaving his body. So that's only Kurt.
We have something to announce.
Get a room.
Okay. Now I'm coming to you, Sam, but other actors, you can answer this. Quentin's obviously very precise in his language. And when you make a Quentin movie, if people don't know, you say the lines that Quentin has written.
Yeah.
As an actor, when there's no...
Not him.
Okay. Yeah, I do.
Every actor here is like, not this motherfucker.
Yes. Come on. Keep the myth up. Keep the myth alive. Yes, we say exactly what Quentin writes.
The other actors have... I mean, I guess this is a good point of debate. What does that give you as an actor when you're staying relatively close? I think other actors may be a little bit closer to what's written in terms of what it gives you as an actor. A lot of actors like to wing it, like to improvise. When you're staying close to the dialogue, what does that benefit you in terms of your performance?
I mean, there's not a lot that you need to change. I mean, Quentin and I have conversations about what I say. And I don't just willy-nilly change things. If I want to say something else, I'll go to him and discuss it with him, and we'll talk about it. And he'll say, well, let me hear what I wrote. And I'll say what he wrote. Well, let me hear what you want to say. And I'll say what I want to say, which is very close to what he wrote. I just want to say it another way because I think it comes out of that character's mouth a different way. And he'll say... okay, or he'll say, no, I'll leave it the way I wrote it. And that's generally what happens. The rest of these motherfuckers need to say what he said.
Yeah.
We're kind of on the same wavelength. Yeah. And generally, when I get it, it's exactly what it needs to be. As characterization starts and as we're in rehearsal, there are times when I'll feel like I didn't say enough, or I didn't have enough to say, and I'll say to him, could you add something here so that I can answer that or clarify this? And Quentin will do that. But by the time the rehearsal period is over and we get there and we're ready to do it, nothing changes except, I mean, the only big change we had from being around the studio table and in minis in the studio and being outdoors with the stagecoach was the cold. That was the one thing, that was the wild card that we didn't really know about. And all of a sudden, it changed the urgency of everything we wanted to do, especially outdoors. It's like, okay, I want to get inside that stagecoach now because I don't like the snow running down my neck.
Bruce, I'm going to ask the same question to you about working with Quentin as an actor. You've worked with a lot of great directors over the course of your career. What is it special to you about working with Quentin, and how does he affect you as an actor?
Well, in my journey, I don't think I've ever said this before, but this is the first movie I've ever done where I felt privileged to lend a hand, because that's what you do for him. He expects everybody, I don't know what percentage you'd say, but let's say casting is 20, 80% of a movie. And he expects the people that he brings to do what he hired them to do and not act and be somebody else. And I felt that he asked me to come along and lend a hand. And so that's basically what it is. I mean, you've got, when you go to work for him, everybody on the set, and we're talking about everybody behind the camera, division by division by division, everybody knows you have a chance to go to the playoffs. But what you don't know is that what you're going to end up in this one, it's my first time in an opera, because the guy made an opera. And just to be a part of that, not, I couldn't sit through a fucking opera, but...
I'm going to turn it over to some audience questions. I'll go here, and be sure to include our back row. We got a lot of people here. So the shorter the better, so we can get to as many as possible. Hang on one sec. We have money.
A question for Quentin. As a filmmaker, you're always more interested in the past, whether it's historical periods or cinematic styles. I just wondered if you ever have a hankering, or how you think you'd tackle it if you looked in the other direction, not necessarily making a film set in the future, but you know, adapting your style away from Westerns and the cult films we have before.
That's, you know, actually, that's a really interesting idea. I don't think anyone's ever proposed it exactly the way you proposed it to me. Everyone always talks about the science fiction genre in particular, which always makes me think about people in spaceships, and that's never. And I can appreciate that, but that's not really where I think my dramatist aspect lies. However, the way you've posed it before, I don't think I've ever thought about it as far as like dealing with a future society like ours. But what would that entail, and what would it mean to jump, you know, 20 years or 50 years or 100 years in the future, and literally look at it from that point of view. I've never really thought about that before, but it's a profound thought, I have to admit.
Let me ask you a corollary of that. Does making a period film allow you the ability to comment on the present in ways that a present-day film doesn't?
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely a case where if you try to deal, I'm not saying it's a bad thing to do, but when you try to deal with prescient themes in the present, you know, that is what you're doing. You know, that is the railroad you're building, and that's where that train is going. And you know, that can actually be fantastic. We can all point at versions in cinema history that has been profound. I do like putting scenario first. I do like putting story first, and I actually like masking whatever I want to say in the guise of genre, so I can say it with my left hand and then deal with the right hand with the genre dictates. However, in this instance per se, or in particular, I guess what I meant is, it's one of the benefits of the Western genre. I think there's no other genre that has deals with America better in a subtextual way than the Westerns being made in the different decades, i.e. like the 50s Westerns very much put forth an Eisenhower idea of America and an American exceptionalism aspect of it, where the Westerns of the 70s were very cynical about America. And it was a drag that first draft of the script got out when it did. However, as we were making this movie, was during that last year and a half where many of the themes that we were dealing with, we were watching on television when we got home, and we would come to the set and we would talk about them. The one good thing about the script getting out there as soon is I'm on record for having written this before all this shit started popping off in the last year and a half.
Yeah.
Next question.
And the other good thing about that, too, is I died a lot earlier in that other script.
Yeah, right. I forgot about that until mentioned it to somebody else.
Yeah, I did.
Well, go here. Wait for your microphone. Again, spread the love around. So you can ask some other people questions.
Mario from Mexico. I'd like to ask with the Mexican fella over there.
Who's a Mexican? Who's a Mexican?
Yeah. You are famous in Mexico to explore to the bones, the characters, and having fun portraying them. Can you talk about how much fun do you have in the set and how much you were allowed to do it in your character?
Viva Mexico, cabrón.
Come on, D.
Yeah, hello, Trump. you know, I just had been sitting in the house seats, you know, from day one, meeting this guy right here, and being a big fan of his films forever. It was just great to see how, you know, to see him in action and see him how he does what he does. And then I remember having this first table reading with all these beautiful actors reading those lines. That was, for me, you know, a beautiful ride. And I still have the best seat in the house, you know. I'm just having a lot of fun. And you need a crazy director, a free director, a director that's not afraid of taking risks in order to help you get, you know, where you want to go. So that's pretty much what we did.
Yeah. Good question. I'm going to go here. Go ahead. Yep. Wait for the mic.
This is for Michael and Tim. You guys have been with Quentin from the very beginning. So what's a then and now situation for
Mr. Kennedy? Michael's ready.
Well, at least we didn't get stuck together this time. Tim and I embraced each other on the set of Reservoir Dogs. We had both so much blood on our bodies that we were stuck together. And we were stuck together like more than we wanted to be. It was like the hug that lasted a little too long. And they actually had to use a garden hose to separate us. Yeah. So it was good in our defense this time that we were on opposite sides of the room. But I enjoyed so much watching Tim and watching him find his character. I think back in the dog days, I was a young man and I was very naive. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Not that I do now, but I enjoyed watching Tim, and I enjoyed watching him much more than I would have remembered from the years before. That's what changed for me is I grew to appreciate and watch him, how wonderful he is, you know, as a friend also.
Tim?
Come on, buddy.
Top that. He's all right.
No tears.
He's all right.
No tears.
No, it's been a trip. It's been a trip. It was kind of a weird sensation to be the old school, the old boys coming, because Sam's been around as much as I have around Quentin. But so I had a long break. I didn't make it back in since sort of Fallen Tropic Pulp Fiction. So for us it was kind of a
four rooms.
Sorry. So I didn't know the new kind of version of how he filmed and the kind of atmosphere that on set that he's encouraged and developed. It was brand new for me. So it was almost, in a sense, like coming to Quentin fresh again. It was wonderful.
Quentin, are you writing for specific actors for most of the roles, some of the roles?
Yeah, in this case, everybody here that I'd worked with before, I wrote for them. In that case, the wild cards were Domergue and Bob and Jody.
Next question. Let's go here. Go ahead. Yeah.
My question is for Walton. What's the over under on whether your character Hate Fleet is related to your character in Django?
I'll say it again. I'm
what's
sorry.
What's over and under, and whether or not your character in Django is related to your character in Hateful Eight?
Wow. Maybe that's his uncle or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. What a shitty family. Shitty group of people. God. I wouldn't want to have
the worst family in America. The Borgias of America.
You said something earlier that was so interesting to me. You talk about Quentin and people talk about Quentin's dialogue, but from an actor's perspective, but you have to understand this is like finding like gold in a river. This is like panning for gold, like in the gold rush days in California. When you come across this, when you get this invitation, and it was one day in particular. This is a great story. There was one day in particular where I read this stuff like 300 times. We all do. And Quentin said at the outset, he said, you need to know these words, as every actor up here does. Not just so that you can be ready at any given moment to kind of go wherever it is in story, but so that you can give this man 100 different versions if that's what he needs in order to reach his vision, right? And that's just kind of what I do. That's how I look at it. And there was one day in particular where Quentin gave me a monologue, and it was just a page. And I spent 14 years in television. Learning 10 pages from me, in an hour is no problem. But this is Quentin Tarantino dialogue. And it started off in the morning. I got it first thing as soon as I got there, right after our coffee, we have a coffee club in the morning. And so I'm sitting there, man, I'm having the best fucking day. I know 150 pages of this script. I know everybody's shit. And then I get this thing, it's like from Coco, who just kind of comes up and says, oh, hey, Quentin wants you to say this later on today. And it's like here, right? It's the whole thing. And it just freaked me out. It brought me down. It was because it's oh fuck, really? Now I got to get up from the coffee and I start walking around, and people see that I'm freaking out a little bit. And Tim says, hey man, what's wrong with you? I said, look, I got this right here. I got this today. I got this today. So you got that, man? No, I don't. I don't fucking have this. And then Kurt, literally an hour later, and I'm just pacing around back and forth, and Kurt said, hey, man, what's wrong with you? I said, this, man, this. And he said, you got this. I said, no, I fucking don't. And then the same with Sam. Sam said something, too, because I just walk and I pace. And then that night, it all came down to, it was the last thing that we shot, and it was with me and Bruce, mm-hmm. and we're sitting there in the chair, and even then, I'm just fucking freaking out, and Quentin just looks at me, and he says, you got this, man. And then it came out.
And it's not in the movie.
No, it is!
What's up? Go ahead.
It's actually embarrassing to ask a downer question after such
an up story, yeah.
But I'm intrigued to know some of the conversations that you, Mr. Jackson, have with Quentin, Bruce Kirkland of the Toronto Sun. And because he touched on it in terms of what he wants to say about society and life, and race relations in America is part of it. History following the Civil War is part of it. All of that plays into what your character is doing in relation to the other characters in the film. I'd love to know how you guys talk about what you want to say about race relations in America.
That's not such a downer question.
No, downer question. It all comes out very genuinely. When we were having those conversations, the biggest one we had was about the Lincoln letter, mm-hmm. and Kurt and how he felt when, you know, his heart got broken. So we had to go through this. Mm-hmm. We had a really interesting conversation that day because
there's a lot of responses you can have to that.
Yeah. I mean, he's trying to be a liberal in a time where there weren't any, mm-hmm. you know, and all of a sudden he's faced with, oh, so it's true what they say about you people. Now, I could fix that, but there was no need for me to fix that because I had to go with, look, the only time I can feel safe is when I disarm you. In the real world, that's a very real thing that happens right now. I mean, we have to be these very nice kind of Negroes so we feel safe walking around, because if you present yourself as any other thing, then people call people on you. And now, I mean, even after the other day, that, you know, if you see something, say something. I feel sorry for everybody who looks, you know, Middle Eastern right now, because that's going to happen. And for a minute, it was us, you know. And when we had that conversation around the table, it was one of those kind of things like, well, if you really feel like you want to be part of the solution, then I actually broke that for Kurt, you know. And I was saying, well, is he really genuinely hurt? Was he disappointed by that? And Kurt had a very great response to that. It's like, well, a lie is a lie is a lie. You know, and it's not that the letter is not real. It's that you lied. You know? It's not the whole thing. It's the lie of who you are and how you presented yourself. and what this thing meant to me. You destroyed it. You know, it's kind of like Quentin has this way of making us look at ourselves in this interesting sort of way. I mean, Major Warren is a lot of things. And one of the things he is a survivor. And he's surviving in a very dangerous time. Because that speech was a lot longer about, you know, you don't know what it is to be a black man in America right now, da-da-da-da-da. It was a longer speech. And he cut it down to the right size. But you don't need to say a lot more about it than that. And we all understand race relations in that time. You know, it's like getting back to the whole nigga, not nigga conversation. It's like when you're talking about me, I can be in the room or out of the room, but you very seldom going to say, yeah, you know the black guy that's with me. You know, it's like, that's not what people said. That's just not how people talk. So whether I'm in the room or out of the room, when they say the nigga, I don't have to look around and see who they're talking about. They're talking about me. Or they're talking around me, but I'm still there. You know, so we don't need to have those conversations because we all understand society in another kind of way. Or as Tim knows British society, Demian knows Mexican society. We all know that everybody has these different stratas of living and everybody's got somebody that they particularly put their foot on or walk around on. So we don't have to talk about it, but we have to make it legitimate enough so that people sitting there, because there's a whole bunch of people who are going to watch this movie that agree with him. There are people that are going to watch the movie that agree with Bruce. There are going to be people that watch the movie that are on my side. Everybody's going to have a fan. Daisy's going to have fans. Mm-hmm. You know? So there are actually people there who wish times were still like they used to be.
I remember when we were doing Django, you go, hey, yeah, make no mistake, Steven will have his fans.
Yes. So when we're there doing that, we know we're not just making a movie for Quentin's fans, because people that hate Quentin and what his movies stand for are still going to go watch this movie just because they like shoot 'em ups. Mm-hmm. And they're going to sit there and go, shit, he hit on my, that's my thing right there. Yeah, damn right, all these niggas lie. You know, and it's just going to be the reality of what they do. Because that's that segment of society. And there are going to be other people sitting there going, oh, my God, I can't believe they talk like that. Mm-hmm. But that's just what movies do. And that's why we make these things, so that we can start conversations or get people thinking. And hopefully that will make a change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Way back, right there in the blue. We have time for about three more questions.
Hi, thank you. Just actually a good follow-up to this is, Quentin, I'd like to ask you about if you have any inkling of what the police union has in store for you after that very, very inappropriate threat that they issued. And isn't it a shame? Do you think that it's those people who should be seeing the movie instead of boycotting it?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because people ask me, like, are you worried? The answer is no, I'm not worried, because I do not feel that the police force is this sinister black hand organization, all right, that goes out and fucks up individual citizens because of a conspiracy kind of way. Having said that, civil servants shouldn't be issuing threats, even rhetorically, to private citizens. No, I don't have any idea. I mean, the only thing I can imagine that they might be planning to do is you know, picket one of the screenings or something like that. Maybe picket the premiere. Maybe picket, you know, one of the 70mm screenings or something like that.
Or buy up all the tickets to make sure the theater's empty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that don't really hurt me that much. Right? Yeah. So no, I don't. I don't have any inkling, and I haven't heard a whole lot about it, other than I think, you know, Patrick Lynch is keeping the fire on simmer. I do think it's unfortunate that because you can't. I I do respect the good work that the police do. Like, I live in the Hollywood Hills. When I see a cop driving around there, I actually assume that he has my best interest in heart, and he has the best interest of my property at heart. And I think if you go to Pasadena, they'd say the same thing. And I think you knock on doors in Glendale and ask them, they'd say the same thing. If you go down to Century Boulevard and start knocking on apartment doors in Inglewood, they're not going to say the same thing. And I think that all that was put into place about 30 years ago when we declared a war on drugs and actually started militarizing the police force. And you're not going to have the police force representing the black and brown community if they've been spending the last 30 years busting every son and daughter and father and mother for every peddling drug offense that they've ever done, and thus creating a mistrust in the community. But at the same time, you should be able to talk about abuses of power, and you should be able to talk about police brutality and what in some cases is, as far as I'm concerned, outright murder and outright loss of justice without the police organization targeting you in the way that they have done me.
Let's go. I think we're going to have one last question. So let's go right here.
Ilan Rahman, rolling out. This is for Quentin. In a sense,
oh, there you go.
In a sense, you've created your own genre. Your movies are powerful and thought-provoking and often dancing on the edge of being politically correct. What are your thoughts on being politically correct in today's society?
I don't have much thought on that. Other than just kind of, I guess, in a conversation like the way you're having it right now, the way you're asking for it to me right now, I just don't think about it that way. I mean, one can be inclined to just say, oh, F this political correctness, I don't have time for that. But also in polite society, there is such a thing as sensitivity to some issues as time has gone on. And there was a time that we weren't politically correct at all. And we all wince at moments when we look past and we see that. I don't really know what the answer is as far as that is concerned. However, me as an artist, I don't really think about it at all. It actually is not my job to think about that. Especially in terms of with me as a writer, in particular, also as a filmmaker, but I'm not worried about the filmmaking part because if I've written it, that's what I'm going to do. But in particularly as a writer, it is my job to ignore social critics or the response that social critics might have when it comes to the opinions of my characters, the way they talk, or anything that can happen to them. I mean, we can talk about we can talk about the race stuff, which we actually talk, but I'm sure some people here sitting in the room might be uncomfortable about the violence that is handed out to Jennifer's character. And actually, I'm playing with that in the course of the movie. When she gets that cracked in the head by John Ruth at the beginning of the movie, that is meant to send a shockwave out through the audience. And you're meant to think. You're not necessarily meant to like Domergue in that moment, but you are meant to think that John Ruth is a brutal bastard at that moment, because that does seem like a rather overreaction to what she did and what she said. Now time goes on and you see how you feel about the characters, but it's meant to do that. But there is this aspect of the way this story works in general is I have trapped 8 people, actually 9 people if you include OB. He's not part of the Hateful Eight because he's not hateful. All right, the Hateful Eight and OB, all right, would be the...
Gabby Hayes.
Yeah. But the thing is, though, but the way the story works, part of the actual, that tension that we're talking about, the pressure cooker that we're talking about, and because of you know where I'm coming from, you know, in that vaguely-esque, Peckinpah-esque way, to some degree or another, is anything can happen to these guys. Anything can happen to these characters. Any piece of outrageous violence could happen to them. And there is, and I paint in a system where there aren't color book lines. I can cross those lines. You know, the way the way graphic novels, I don't mean graphic novels as in a comic book, but the way novels that deal with violence kind of almost seem to go anywhere in a way that movies aren't allowed to go. And so in that scenario, what, I'm going to make it that, oh, seven of these characters, anything can happen to them, but when it comes to this eighth character, I have to protect her because she's a woman and they can't have the destiny that it can happen to any of these other characters? No, that goes against the entire story. I'm not going to think like that. And when I think of, I guess, a bit basically an artistic hero in that, you know, predecessor when it comes to that, I think of somebody like Ken Russell, who was... you know, who was raked over the coals by the press in England constantly for the boundaries he pushed. And he said, in especially in response to something like the Devils or something, was like, you know, do they let these people get you down? And he goes, I don't think about them. I can't think about them. It's my job not to think about them because I believe in what I'm doing 100%. And I am doing what I'm doing. If you don't like it, don't go see it.
Well, way to end. Thank you, guys.